the good, the bad, and the cross. Westerns, cowboys, Wyatt Earp, gunfight at the OK Corral. I know you're wondering where this is going. I know you're wondering where this is going. I once lived with a Catholic priest, Father Brunig. He liked Westerns. I rented a small apartment in his parish and frequently came out to join him in his living room. We watched a lot of old movies on his black and white TV. He called Westerns morality plays. I knew the drama in Westerns imitated life and is sometimes larger than life, but something about the way Father Brunig explained Westerns made them seem, well, a little Shakespearean and a little biblical. I know this isn't what you see when you're picturing John Wayne sitting tall in the saddle, but Father Brunig saw deeper meaning and commentary in the genre native to this country. And his kind of analysis explains why certain Westerns such as High Noon, Shane, or Unforgiven are classics. Westerns like these took the Hollywood out of John Wayne, took the Hollywood John Wayne out of the story. In its place came realistic depictions of the human condition. It's too early to see how these classics withstand the test of time. However, one hint of their longevity is in the frequency of their retelling. The only Western story more renowned than Wyatt Earp's is the Plains Indians' Last Stand, commonly told as Custer's Last Stand. History, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. Thus, to us with roots in the northeast quadrant of the country, Wyatt Earp's story may be a remote and parochial one. That's a privileged perspective. Benefiting from the 13 colonies transplanting European civilization, our culture got handed to us. But in the South was a plantation culture populated with enslaved Africans from another civilization. In the West were genocide and eradication of Native American culture. We don't look west for Sodom and Gomorrah, to which some old West towns like Dodge City and Tombstone are compared. With the perspective of the privileged, we opt to look south and liken the suffering of God's chosen people to slaves under pharaohs in the Old Testament. It's less defensible to look west and relate God's chosen people to conquerors, like the ones displacing the Canaanites from the land. That's too much like evicting Native Americans from their land using the U.S. cavalry and the doctrine of discovery. But the good, the bad, and the cross are too interwoven into the fabric of our nation. We have to be like seamsters to pull out the thread containing lessons from which to learn. Briefly then, know that one highlight of the Wyatt Earp story still echoes today, gun control. Wyatt Earp took guns from people, no debate, no waiting, no NRA. The gunfight at the OK Corral was one of the first instances of the law disarming a town. Our folklore says that the gunfight ended a feud between two sets of brothers on opposite sides of the law, the Clantons and the Earps. What it really had been is the beginning of new life in the territory. For U.S. Marshal Wyatt Earp had also been among 200 U.S. Marshals, women and African Americans included, sent by a federal judge to clean up the Old West. Anything short of them meant military intervention. Not since the Civil War had General Sherman proposed marching across U.S. soil. How bad was our West? Bands of men comprised this nation's first organized crime. They called themselves the Cowboys. You thought I was going to say the Mafia, didn't you? Back then, you didn't call one of them a cowboy. You called them the cowboy. The Cowboys terrorized towns, regions, and parts of Mexico. Imagine Amazon warehouses regularly looted, the U.S. Postal Service frequently stopped, or Amtrak being too dangerous to ride. That would be life today under the Cowboys. Like the Germanic tribes that called the Vandals who wrecked the Roman Empire so bad that their name got entered into our vocabulary, Vandals, so it was with the Cowboys. The word cowboy didn't exist then, or didn't exist before them. Today, when you picture cowboys, you think of gunfights. That was an image purposely created and cultivated by the cowboys. It was another way organized crime instilled fear in the populace. That image has long since lost its potency, thanks to Hollywood, but leaves the West no less mythologized. Don't worry, I haven't forgotten what the sermon's about. I only want to mirror a momentous time in our civilization with a monumental one in our country. The West doesn't have Pharisees and Romans. It has the cowboys. In them isn't entertainment, but manifestation of the bad that good has to confront, the way, well, Father Brunig might tell it. Jesus isn't laying down the law of the land. He's laying down the law of life. He doesn't have the cowboys. He has the Pharisees. He's not sent by a judge. He's sent by God. Jesus gets thrown a lot of legal technicalities, as have been the buildup to our famed gunfight. First, he's eating grain on the wrong field. Next, he's healing a withered hand on the wrong day. Then he's casting out demons in the wrong name. And after all they've seen, adversaries demanded a sign. Still frustrated, they finally play the family card. Jesus is supposed to stop preaching when his mother and brothers show up, appear. The family card. It's one of Satan's favorite plays. Sexual predators and families convince who they molest to protect them. They count on the molested one's reluctance to embarrass and divide the family. Even when soldiers described the American Civil War as brother against brother, they didn't stop fighting. We can hear Satan gloat, "Who needs tricks when I can play the family?" Jesus turns the devil's play into a teaching moment. Of course, families sometimes got subordinated. Roman soldiers around them did that when pledging their lives to Caesar. Merchants traveling afar for commerce often left families behind. The people Jesus addressed already knew family didn't always come first. The ideal of family is meant to counter what's real. Families are as broken as people. So Jesus rephrases the question. He sidesteps the shame and honor culture of his audience. It's not about obligation and neglect. It's about volition and devotion. Reflexive as it is to think family first, Jesus explained the other family first, his spiritual family. It's about loving the stranger and enemies, nothing less than revolutionary. Eventually comes an inevitable confrontation between good and evil. At the end of the four Gospels, we don't get an okay corral. We get Golgotha. Jesus isn't the last man standing. He's the only man down. Even he asked God if there had been some other way. We read in Luke an account of Jesus' last prayer. In his anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood. This isn't the template for an American legend. It's the template for Martyr's Mirror. In Hebrews, Jesus is presented as heroic, pioneer, brother, liberator, high priest. He shows no fear of a showdown when calling Pharisees vipers, nor is he shown to be meek elsewhere in the Gospels when overturning tables and slinging whips. He's not the new sheriff in town. He's the new life in life. Divinity is his badge, salvation is his duty, and disciples are his posse. He's not riding the range chasing outlaws. He's walking the land changing lives. But to finish, he has to sacrifice himself for the very family about which he preached. We don't think of Jesus as taking orders, but he does. He doesn't appear to get it, but God clarifies it in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus sweats blood. To save his spiritual family, he has to be its first martyr. Today is the 10th anniversary of my neurosurgery for a tumor, July 21st. I call it my second birthday. After 54 years of ability, I had to redefine myself in terms of inability. Classified as disabled, I had numerous medical problems, the most public being my seizures. In my early days after surgery, I volunteered at a ministry where people experiencing homelessness went during the day. I related to them because I'd once been homeless too. A long time ago, I lived in my car, another time in the prayer room of a college campus. When a teacher discovered me, he sent me to Father Brudig. One day I befriended a man in the ministry where I volunteered. Like Father Brunig and I, this man and I talked. Over time, I learned how misunderstood was his medical condition. Well, even by lawyers who were trying to help him with Social Security disability forms. Few people understand disabled people who don't immediately and outwardly show disability. A term exists for us, invisible disability. One condition this man and I shared was seizures, suddenly losing consciousness and falling to the ground. Seizures cost this man places in line at shelters, 1 minute standing, next, falling to the ground. He'd wake up in emergency rooms having nowhere to go when discharged. One day, in an emotional pivot in our relationship, he told me, "You're the only one who understands." The only one who understands. To whom else do we say that? In the Garden of Gethsemane, when he learned he'd die, Jesus had been seen falling to the ground. My propensity for missing the lesson in biblical stories, I'm sure, prevents me from getting Jesus' story exactly right. However, through my disability, I think I understand it. I think I better understand it. In that ministry, people related to me because my life had been like theirs. This time, this is what it sounds like Jesus did, made his life like ours, if only for a little while. In every respect, reads Hebrews, Jesus had to be like his brothers and sisters. We also read why. Because he himself was tested by what he suffered, he is able to help those being tested. Jesus wasn't just with us, he was one of us, in death too. There's another theme in the Wired Up story, victim becoming victor. Wired Up lost brothers to murderous cowboys, and local law shielding the cowboys chased him. He knew what it was like being an unprotected citizen in the West, and it helped make him an effective protector of citizens. One kernel of truth about Wired Up is that his saddle, coat, and others around him took bullets in many gunfights, but never him. This undisputed fact created his larger-than-life image, as if death had no power over him. Jesus rose from the dead. The Roman guards monitoring him swore secrecy because they feared no one to believe their report. It's a risen Jesus in Acts who talks to a violent unbeliever knocked off his horse, Saul, who couldn't have possibly known he'd foreshadow a wounded cowboy falling off his horse. Like Wyatt Earp breaking the power of the cowboys, Jesus broke the power of death. I get bad guys biting the dust, but I'm not sure I fully understand defeating death. I won't rise from death like Tabitha in Acts or Lazarus in John. My best comprehension, then, is what I learned from a former member of our church. He passed some years ago from a terminal illness, with this church, he openly shared his journey to the end of his life, especially with the children. He told us the closer he came to death, the closer he felt to Jesus. That's still unfathomable to me, maybe because I can't conceive of my own death. Still, I heard the testimony of a member of my church. If I couldn't see Jesus myself, I tried looking through the eyes of others. You may see how Father Brunig might have told Wired Earp's story. We have a faith defined by Jesus and a country defined by Wyatt Earp. One authority in the West noted that historians recognize golden ages and civilizations with each having a defining larger-than-life moment with larger-than-life people. King Arthur was Britain's, Romulus and Remus were Rome's, and in a 30-second gunfight, Wyatt Earp became America's. Hence, you may also see how the United States became, in the words of Shane Claiborne and Michael Martin, the most dangerous industrialized nation in the world. It's a feat to follow Jesus in a violent world. John Roth, professor of history at Goshen College, wrote about the Martyr's Mirror in his essay, The Complex Legacy of the Martyr's Mirror. He writes that we need not just shared stories to unify us, but the unsettling ones. Certainly, gunfights are as violent as torture is gruesome. Unsettling stories pinpoint and define where we are in our naivety, our ignorance, our culture, or faith. They remind us that the country and the world in which we choose to be Christian doesn't play, and that there has been and still is a cost to being who we say we want to be. The author of Martyr's Mirror believed martyrdom would be a unifying theme for Anabaptists, among whom Mennonites are counted. The Martyr's Mirror is a lengthy book published in the Netherlands in 1660, documenting thousands of deaths of Anabaptists, torturously killed because of their faith. The template for unifying martyrdom is in the Bible is Jesus, followed by Stephen at the hands of Saul in Acts. Mr. Roth also mentions the domestication of faith in North America. In this now relatively tamed environment, we have something Mennonite sisters and brothers elsewhere in the world don't. The luxury to not regard our faith as the culmination of decisions about how to die. Churches don't prepare congregants for martyrdom any more than society prepares citizens for heroism. Martyrs and heroes took up that burden for us. The Old West mirrors today. We don't have a judge pulling Weirdrup out of retirement, as history tells. We have a Congress pulling special counsel Robert Mueller out of silence. We have a president behind whom generals won't stand. We have a world in which oppressive autocrats eagerly stand. Our Old West could be allegory for the world's Western civilization. A whole civilization is too big for a wide Europe, but not for Jesus.